December 8th, 2015, Conservative Judaism, today and tomorrow. So, let me, actually, you know what, at a time when there's an increased amount of beheading going on in the world today. But sure enough, there's this notion in the Jewish national subconscious that Judith is our heroine for Hanukkah. Now, there's another Jewish female heroine on Hanukkah, and that is a Jewish woman named Hannah.
Yeah.
Now, what is she known for?
Seven sons.
Is she the one who went to the temple and she was praying to have a child and the priest?
That is the Hannah that is mentioned in the Hebrew Bible that we read about on the first day. I know you've been in shul on the first day of Rosh Hashanah because we do read that Haftarah on the first day of Rosh Hashanah. Different Hannah in the Apocrypha. What do you say?
She had seven sons.
Seven sons. And what's so special about these seven sons?
They were murdered by the Greeks.
Yes, they were murdered by the Greeks in front of her. In front of her, they were martyred by the Greeks. And I use the term martyr to refer to someone who's killed for his or her beliefs, who could make a choice not to, right? But the notion is they chose to be killed rather than to desecrate or to defile themselves, okay? Hannah is their mom, and I think she was killed after the seven sons were killed. So that's a gruesome story. I believe it is preserved in the Book of Maccabees. But when we think about playing by the light of the shamash, because that's what we're doing, we're playing by the light of the shamash. We're not playing by the light of the other candles, right? Because we're not allowed to use them. Ein lanu rishut lishtamesh bahem. We're just supposed to enjoy them. So that's why you need a shamash. Even in a case of an electric Hanukkah, when you're not actually using the shamash to light the other ones, you need a shamash, the helper candle, so that you can see the Hanukkah and you can see the area around it and not make use of the light from the Hanukkah itself. Of course, that gets to be a little bit of a legal fiction on the eighth night of Hanukkah when so many of these other candles are burning, but that's the idea. We're not supposed to use them. So we have this notion that we're supposed to play. Why play with a dreidel? That's fun. That's fine. Why play with a dreidel? You know, it's very interesting. I mean, the word dreidel, it's German. And so it was most likely a toy that was actually played by Gentiles, and then it became a Jewish practice to play with this. Okay, but then there's a wonderful teaching I shared it with Lisa a couple of days ago from Sefer Hamit Amim, a medieval collection, late medieval actually, a collection of customs, and it says that on Purim we twirl the groger. But on Hanukkah, we twirl the dreidel, and they're different. The groger, we twirl like this. The dreidel, we twirl like this. And why would that be? On Purim, what do we celebrate? And on Hanukkah, what do we celebrate? That might be reflected in the different orientations of these ritual objects. Well, you tell me. Okay.
I do.
Well, we shake the groger from below. We twirl from below. And on Hanukkah, the twirling is from above.
Except for Don.
Except, right, if you're able to perfect this, I know some people are counter, right, exactly. Okay, the idea is very simple, really. By the way, did you get a dreidel? We passed them around before Lisa came here. She should get at least one dreidel. She doesn't need a lot, just one.
See if you can find one that works.
The idea is that on Purim, there's hit orerut from below. There was a response from below. Esther and Mordechai and the people, they fasted, they prayed, they made things happen from below. Whereas on Hanukkah, we give thanks to God for putting things in motion in such a way that Nes Gadol Hayasha. It's an interesting observation about the different ways.
You're saying God had no role in Purim?
I'm sorry?
You're saying God had no role in Purim?
How many times is God mentioned in the Book of Esther?
None.
Correct.
We talked about that.
Right. So the idea is that there's this notion that you know, the miracle of Purim, if it's a miracle of Purim, is that people were actually able to get together and make it happen. It's a very earthy in that respect.
I've got a simple question. Why would I buy a box of candles for Hanukkah? Are there 45 and not 44 in the box?
There should be 44.
This one says
maybe it's an extra because maybe you'll break one.
This company, the one that makes the longer one, writes something.
You know what? It probably is because they fit better in the box. I bet that's it. But what I was going to say is that there are 44 because you have a shamash each night. But without the shamash, without the shamashim, how many candles do you light from day one through day eight?
36.
Correct.
36.
Easy
math.
Now, in Hebrew, how would you represent by letters the number 36?
Lamed Vav,
okay? Here we go. Lamed Vav, because, you know, Aleph Bet Gimel Dalet Hey Vav Yud, Hey Vav Zayin Chet Tet Yud, that's 1 to 10. And then after the 10, the letters take on the powers of 10. Kaf is 20, Lamed is 30. Mem is 40, Nun is 50, Samech is 60, Ayin is 70, Fei is 80, Tzadi is 90, Kuf is 100, Resh is 200, Shin is 300, and Tav is 400. You can see why, even though we're very good at math, you know, Jews are very good at math, the Hebrew mathematical system never was going to take off with that kind of division. But so then you have Lamed Vav, stands for 36, okay? So there's a verse in Isaiah chapter 4, verse 2. God, you know, Isaiah has a vision of God, and it says he saw seraphim omdim lo mima'al. There were seraphim. Do we know what the seraphim are? Do we have any? They're like angels, okay? They're angels, okay, or God's emissaries, okay? Omdim lo mima'al. So, seraphim, omdim lo mima'al. Literally, it means seraphim, which we really can't translate. There's some sort of angelic beings standing above lo, okay, which means him. That's, okay, Isaiah has a vision. There were seraphim standing above him being God. He had a vision. But Lamed Vav also stands for 36. So this verse, which is Isaiah 4, verse 2, is used as a proof text, or not really a proof text, as a hint or an allusion to the practice of having the shamash candle be above the other ones. It should be above the other ones because, like the seraphim, it stands above the 36. Right, because we have eight of them all together, so that's why you have a plural. And seraphim are like servants; they are like the emissaries. Okay, they stand above the 36, meaning the 36 candles. This came up in a little session that we had with a group of kids from the Unitarian Church in town who came here, and you know, we were looking at the Hanukkah and we talked about the practice, and one girl, very perceptive, very thoughtful young woman, sixth grade. Do you teach sixth grade? You don't teach the grade. Sixth grade, I was really very touched by this. She said, you know, but why should the servant candles be above the other ones? It makes it seem like they're more important. Why not? If you call them the servant candle, maybe it should be below. So I said, well, in our tradition, you know, servants are held in high esteem. A servant, you know, really, it's true. The notion of being an Eved Adonai, or an Eved Hashem, is the idea of serving is a truly high calling. So that's one reason, but this is another reason. This didn't make much sense to them, but in any event. Okay, so I thought it would be nice to share a little bit of taste of Hanukkah for a number of reasons. It partly kind of gets us into our subject matter today. And are we still taping here? Yes, it's still moving on, okay. So today, the notion was that we were going to cover three of the chapters in this pamphlet. And those were the chapter on learning, the chapter on mitzvah, and the chapter on tefillah or shul. And what I wanted to do today as an introduction, here we are, is I wanted to say a few words about learning, and then I wanted you to watch the very short video with Arnold Eisen. Did anybody watch the video?
Yeah.
Okay. Oh, so you did.
I thought we were supposed to.
You are very, I'll tell you, very compliant about certain things. It's really very good.
Education.
I am so glad. Okay, but that'll become interesting and important when we get to the second of our units tonight, which is Mitzvah, right?
Watch that film.
What was that?
I watched that film too.
Well, that's less. Okay. I'm glad. I really am glad, David. Really. So when we talk about learning as a focus of activity or a focus of attention, and really as one way of distinguishing, let's say, a conservative community from a non-conservative community, or a conservative Jew from a non-conservative Jew, what comes into your mind? And obviously, if you saw the video, you already have some hint, but I want you to be thinking, what kind of learning are we talking about when we talk about the focus of learning? Is this the same as the kind of learning that has always been understood to be Jewish learning? What kind of Jewish learning do we stand for here? And as you listen to Arne Eisen, and if you listened to it before, you'll listen again, there's a bit of a polemic going on. And the question is, with whom is the polemic? By polemic, I mean he seems to be making a point towards someone. Who is the someone? And he's saying something very bold that you might not have expected him to say. What is it? Okay? Second, and he'll address this, but I want you to be thinking, even before we watch the video, what is the purpose of learning? Why learn? What is that all about? Why learn? Okay? Let's just talk about that for like 1 minute before we watch the video. That last one, like, why learn? Why would learning be important in a religious community, in this particular religious community? Why learn? That needs to be addressed because, you know, it's interesting. I was at a school committee meeting last night with Risa, and we were talking about learning in the community to be engaged in by the young people of the community. But, of course, when we talk about learning in a Jewish community such as ours, we're talking about people of all ages. The question that we asked last night, we can ask the same question now. You know, why learn? What is it that we should be learning, and why? What is the purpose? What is the ultimate goal? Any thoughts about goal? Yeah.
Well, one is to improve oneself.
Yes, that's a pretty you hit the jackpot there, right? I mean, if you think about it, to improve oneself is such a noble and a lofty goal. It's sort of like anything else might seem pale by comparison. Right, you don't say that with you know, but of course that those words could be used to describe other kinds of learning, and it may not be as lofty, right? You know, you might want to learn how to do a lot of things, crafts, for example. You might want to learn a new skill. You might want to learn how to play the saxophone. You might want to learn to do certain things, and you might say to improve yourself because anything we learn, you know, improves ourselves, but when we think about learning in a shul or in connection with our Jewish life, why would it be an improvement? What do we mean by the word improvement in that sentence? What do you think?
Well,
let's hear what Don has to say.
A tradition or history.
Okay, and why would that be an improvement? I'm pushing on this question because I want to try to get a sense. What is it that? Why is what we want to learn going to be something that will improve us? Yeah.
So I think, well, if you have a historical perspective,
okay,
then you may not repeat errors that were made before.
Oh, that's very interesting.
So then you
okay.
can improve yourself going forward. So you can learn from history and not...
Very interesting. Okay.
Yeah, have so a couple... Preserving.
I don't think that's Arnie's preserving much, but
it is a good point.
It's okay. Don's in the room. I want to hear what Don has to say. I'm curious what we think, and then we're going to listen to Arnie Eisen and compare. We have a couple of other hands. Let's go around in this... Wait, I think you missed it, David. We're up to Carol.
Well, I have my hand up. Okay. You missed me.
I'm sorry. I apologize. Yes.
I have listened.
You have.
No, I have not.
Okay.
So, I think you need to learn our own history to preserve and transmit our tradition, but you also need to learn how we've modified, as conservatives, our tradition so that we can learn how to modify it for ourselves and our children.
Okay.
And that's something he did stress in the reading that we did.
Okay, yes. Okay. Risa.
I was going to say, you need to learn how to what's right, how to be upstanding and moral.
Yeah. I mean, bottom line is, you know, if, I guess we don't need a question mark there. I mean, if we're not learning what's right here, where are we going to learn it? And if we're not learning what's right here, why bother to learn it? It's that essential. So, I mean, that sort of fits in the, with the loftiest of the sort of overtones of Bruce's comment. You want to improve yourself. This is about, I mean, improving yourself in with a capital I. Did you have your hand as well?
I was going to say, learning helps you improve your relationship with God in Judaism.
Yes, improve your relationship with God, with Judaism, with...
your community.
Your community. I mean, if you're talking about relationships, a lot of relationships can be enhanced through learning. God, community, yes? And then I didn't want to...
well, I was going to say about the community, so that's...
Uh-huh, yes, Stephen?
If you study mice going through mazes or something else like that, and frequently you're doing that because you're studying how they learn or what they've learned.
Yes.
What you're really studying is their behavior, because it's the only way you can measure learning. And I think that's very true for people. Learning is the outcome of learning is it does it change your behavior?
Is that it does change your behavior?
Is that, well, if you learn, yes.
So this is very interesting, because, you know, behavior will come up in Arne Eisen's little video, and let's try to understand what he means by behavior and what we mean by behavior. Okay? Yes, David?
All I was going to say is, when you learn with other people, you learn differently than if
yes.
you learn on your own.
Yes.
And I think that's a point that's important.
That's very, very interesting. And Jewish learning, for the most part, I mean, this is a very interesting, you know, There is a tradition of learning in groups, or in dyads and triads, and in groups in yeshiva. There is also a tradition of solitary learning in our tradition, and that should not ever be overlooked. It's, you know, in a sense, you need both, and that's probably also recognized, don't you think, in modern educational theory with kids of different ages. I mean, I know when I was growing up, we. You know, I think I went to a penitentiary school. It felt like it was a public school in Philadelphia, and I don't think I ever was allowed to talk to anybody else in the school, much less study with another person. That was really a very, you know, rigid educational program. But now, in some places, you're talking all the time with other kids, and there's that issue as well. When do you have the time to just read and think by yourself? But let's... I also just want to clarify something. We sometimes use these, this, but still a bit of an introduction to the video, but this is so fascinating. We might use these as synonyms: tradition, history. You need to know our history to know what mistakes not to make. We need to know our tradition, because it helps ground us, decide who we are. That's not to be taken, we can't take that for granted. The notion of studying history is, Jewishly speaking, a radical notion. Because history suggests that you are interested in facts, in data. Right? You want to know what happened. Right? You want history, not story. Okay? Now, I'm not calling it fiction, but I'm calling it story because it's a rendering of what happened, and it's a particular perspective on what happened, unabashedly a particular perspective. The Torah is not a work of history. The Torah is a work of tradition. It's a work of story. It's not a work of history. The notion of history is, frankly, foreign to the Jewish notion of tradition. How do we know this? the best evidence possible is you look in the Bible. Start with page one. And what do we see? We see a story about the creation of the world, right? It's a great story. And then you turn the page, and guess what? There's a second story about the creation of the world. And guess what? They're not consistent. And I know this is the kind of thing, you know, David and I have talked about this in the past. How can they be right there next to one another? You have chapter 1 through chapter 2, verse 3, and then you have chapter 2, verse 3.5 or 4, through the end of chapter 2, and, when was the water created? When was this created? When did this happen? They're not consistent, and they're right there next to one another. We have preserved a tradition of looking at the past with binocular vision and not being bent out of shape about that. Okay? In other words, we have deliberately preserved within our tradition alternate views of the same phenomenon coexisting with one another. And so the notion of actually looking at history, as we'll see in a few minutes, is actually a modern notion.
Are you distinguishing the accuracy of history from we don't care how accurate it is in stories?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite...
Are you in this distinction between history and tradition? Is history designed to be accurate in its telling, whereas tradition is...
History is designed to be accurate. Tradition is designed to teach us how to live.
Right, apocryphal, whatever.
Well, no, I don't like to use the word apocryphal because that means excluded from the canon. It has come to mean, as a secondary meaning, the idea that it's legendary.
Okay.
And I think that... But that's not a bad way to understand tradition. But let's listen to Arne Eisen and see what he has to say. And what do we agree and what do we disagree? I think you'll be able to see this from here. Is it loud enough?
Yeah, I'm sure.
Our focus in this essay is Tefillah, which I understand as standing before God, however we understand
God. Oh, wait,
this
is not the one I wanted to watch. I'm sorry. Not the right chapter. Go. Stop.
Escape.
There we go. Very good. Sorry, folks. I apologize for that. I was obviously, distracted. There we go. Video introduction. It's pretty fast. Here we go. And make it larger. And we're going to get started. Here we go. Sorry about that.
He's still wearing the same outfit.
He is, and the books are the same. They haven't changed. They should really have him move to a different room. I know, I agree. Learning.
I think that learning may well be the most distinctive aspect of conservative Judaism and that which most sets it apart from other kinds of Judaism. To me, it all goes back to the central command to love the Lord our God and therefore study God's Torah, our Torah, with all of our heart, and not part of it, all of our mind, all of our soul, all of our might. We can't leave any aspect of our knowledge or our experience out of the enterprise. If science has relevant things to teach us, we want to know about science. If philosophy helps us figure out how to act in this world as good human beings, then we want to know what philosophy has to teach us. If other traditions, including other faith communities, have wisdom in them from which we can learn, we want to do that. And Judaism has commanded that, and certainly conservative Judaism has always stressed that. This is part of what sets conservative Judaism apart, and frankly, what sets JTS apart from other schools. We study the sources in great depth, but we also want our students to know the context behind the text, stemming from the text, and we want our students to know everything they can about this big, wide world which we want to be a part of and help make better. So that's one key to Jewish learning that conservative Judaism carries forward with great energy and commitment. There's something else that's characteristic of Jewish learning.
We should stop right here just for a second if I can...
There's no learning without practice.
Oh, okay. Well, before we get to that. So the first point he's making here is the nature of the object of learning. As I listened to it the first time, and then I listened to it again, there is something odd about listening to the chancellor of a rabbinical school talking, before really getting into detail about Torah, talking about science and history and all of that. So what's that all about? Why is he emphasizing that here? In a sense, he's looking over his right shoulder. And he's pointing out something that may not even necessarily be apparent to any of us, but is apparent when we enter the world of orthodoxy and we recognize the blinders that are set up. And that's something that is often overlooked. In fact, and intentionally so, because it is inconsistent with the liberal approach to learning that prevails in many of our communities. So orthodoxy would never be able to make inroads if, in fact, it made a point of that closed-mindedness. Now, the nature of the closed-mindedness is in making a distinction between, frankly, tradition and history. There is a limitation on the study of history within orthodoxy. It's actually off the table when it comes to, and it, you know, it doesn't matter. Let's move this for a second. In different decades, frankly, it's focused on something different. But the bottom line is that certain things are off the table, depending, of course, on which Orthodox community you happen to be a part of. But certainly, investigating the historicity of Torah narratives, or the historicity of the Sinaitic event, or the historicity of many of the assumptions that Orthodox Jews will make about the tradition and its transmission, those are still things, those are weak links in the chain of tradition, in Orthodoxy and other expressions of Judaism to the right of conservative Judaism. Question?
It's not a question, it's a statement. I have trouble with a lot of what he's presenting here as trying to symbolize uniqueness to the conservative perspective.
Yeah, we'll get to that.
But he does it to versus
we'll get to that.
The reform side.
We'll get to that.
Okay.
But you're absolutely right. That's the point I wanted to make, is that his polemic right now is against traditionalist learning. And, you know, it reminds me of a conversation I actually had a number of years ago. It came up because I was teaching a class earlier today. Elisa happened to be in the class, in which I mentioned the great 20th century Jewish theologian Richard Rubinstein, very imperious and uncompromising and wickedly brilliant and opinionated scholar, who really transformed really American Jewish philosophy in the 60s and 70s with his book After Auschwitz. Very, very interesting work. And he really straddled the divide between religious Judaism and, in essence, secular Judaism. Very interesting. He was a professor of philosophy at Pitt and also a Hillel rabbi for a time, and then he left that. And then did work in Florida and in Connecticut. He's still alive and I think still well, writing in, well into his 90s. I remember once meeting him in the 70s, and I happened to mention, or it was mentioned about me, that I was studying Talmud, and he said, "Ah, I hope one day you study the context as well as the text." It's kind of a turn of phrase, but what did he mean? He meant, don't just study the text, study the context. Understand Talmud in the context in which it was produced. Now, you're absolutely right. This really does not distinguish, quote-unquote, conservative Judaism presented this way from the Jewish expressions to the left of conservative Judaism, certainly within a reform community, within a renewal community, within a Reconstructionist community. You're going to find a total comfort with looking at history and looking at science and looking at the other sources of knowledge in the world. What he could go on to say, and which he didn't go on to say, which we should think about, is to what extent is within the conservative movement still a focus on seeing these as parallel to one another in their ability to teach us and to guide us. And It's always a balance, right? The question is it the right balance? The notion is, as you go to the right, the balance comes down this way. This goes higher up. When you go to the left, the balance shifts. I think that that's what he would argue is the case. Yeah?
So, I just have a quick question, because I'm teasing out what Riza said when she said, you know, to learn what's right. I'm trying to figure that out. So to me,
yes,
what the learning is doing is giving you context. Let's say I came in here and never had learned a thing in
right.
my life.
Right.
How would I know what's right or wrong? No idea.
Well,
what I learned that day. But then if I go somewhere else and learn something else, then I have context to judge what's...
You know, this is very interesting because that story comes up, of course, in the Talmud with the student coming to, you know, study from Hillel. And it's a very interesting story because the notion is that, you know, he comes before Hillel, and there's a little bit of a different story than maybe this is what you're asking for, but I think there's a relevance to this, okay? So someone comes before... There's a whole bunch of stories on the same page of Talmud about students coming before Shammai, and then they come before Hillel. Why do they first go to Shammai? Because, you know, he's a well-known person, a great scholar, a teacher. And then, of course, he shoos them out the door. They come to Hillel. Hillel welcomes them. And we therefore learn the primacy of Hillel as a model of gentleness, of modesty, and of ability to work with people. So, okay, so somebody comes before Shammai and says, I want you to teach me the Torah Shebichtav, the Torah, as it's written in the text, without the oral tradition that comes from it. Okay? In other words, he doesn't want to hear about the Talmud and about later Jewish tradition. He just wants what's written down in the Torah. So Shammai says that's ridiculous. You can't do one without the other. You need both. You need the written Torah and the oral Torah. Kicks him out the door. He goes to Hillel. Hillel says, fine. He says, I'm going to start, you know, right now, and I'm going to teach you, you know, the written Torah, and we don't have to worry about the oral Torah. No problem. Okay? So he says, but first what we want to do is I want to teach you Hebrew. And this is a very important lesson. Do you need to learn Hebrew in order to be able to move through this? So he first goes up there and he writes a letter up here. And he says, this is the letter Aleph. Okay, Aleph. Okay, this is Aleph. Very good. And then this is the letter Bet. Okay, very good. You get the idea, you know. You get, okay, terrific. So he's terrific. And so Hillel says, okay, now go home and learn it, then come back and we'll study again tomorrow. The next day, he comes back in and Hillel says, okay, so let's just review. This is the Aleph. Okay. And then this is the Bet. Okay, so the man says, I don't understand. Yesterday I came in, you told me this was the Aleph and this is the Bet. Today you're teaching me differently. So Hillel says, you see, you need to rely on me. You need to rely on me because without my telling you that this is the Aleph and this is the Bet, you wouldn't know. There needs to be an oral traditional component to this. So now what Don is suggesting is that role is not played by tradition, it's played by context. Learning the facts helps you see it. And I would say that that's probably absolutely true in terms of how we learn today. We don't rely. In other words, I mean, you might go to Rav Google, you know, but Rav Google is going to, you're going to rely on Rav Google because it's going to be the product of this crowdsourcing phenomenon. You want to know who, you know, Antonius the second was. So you're going to go to Rav Google and you're going to rely on that because enough people have looked at it that should teach you that this is probably reliable, right? But as we know, not all web pages were created equal. And some are filled with crap, right? If you'll pardon the expression, and others are really high quality. And actually, I would think teaching young people in particular to distinguish between a web page that's worth reading, one that must be so difficult.
It used to be.
Why is it less difficult?
Because they're savvy to it.
Already?
Yeah. It's amazing.
That is amazing. But how are they savvy to it?
Well, first of all, you don't land on crap as much as you used to.
Because
again, Rav Google is refined.
So many people are looking. Was that?
I said Rav Google has refined. Like you don't.
Yes.
It's there's so much out there, and it's so.
That's so interesting.
Over.
But okay.
The thing that's coming to my mind, I don't know if I'm going a little off topic, is that today I was studying Great Expectations with these, you know, very very young people, and they said. This kid in the story of Victorian England is trusting an unknown benefactor. character, someone he's never seen.
Mm-hmm.
And the kid applied this modern lesson back on that, and he said, you know, it's just like we learn about the internet. You should never trust someone that you haven't seen. And I was just amazed.
Wow.
Because there is a way that, you know, there's no way, and I think it's relevant here, because there's no way that that lesson about trusting who you can't see through the computer could possibly have been in Dickens's mind, but it's still relevant. And so you can look back through modernity to tradition, and it has something to offer.
Yes, it does. It also says you can't not do that.
Right.
You can't not look through the lens of the 21st century when we're looking back. And that's perfectly fine. Okay? There, or let's put it this way. You can do it, but you'd have to put up blinders. Yes.
Faith.
Hmm?
It's faith versus fact. A little bit. Well, not totally.
No, but that's, you know, I would look at it that way, but I don't like to use the word faith that way, because I think the word faith is a broader word than, but you're absolutely right. In general, and I was just having this discussion earlier today, to me, what is the most destructive of religious faith is the notion that faith requires you to believe what you know to be false. And if faith means believing what you know to be false to be true, then that's not a good use of the word faith. I don't think it's a good use of the word faith, but it often is understood by secular people, by non-religious people, that that's what it means. And that's destructive of faith, and it's destructive of community, and it's destructive of a sense of the usability of the tradition, or even of the history, for that matter. So I think, you know, I actually think that this is an okay presentation, but it's limited. He hasn't gotten to the real point, I don't think he actually gets to it even at the end of the next section, which centers on what I erased. Good job. You get back. This is great. You leave this here, and then tomorrow the kids will come into Hebrew school. Oh, well, you know.
That was Rabbi Perkins.
Yes. There he was. Scary. Very scary. So, you know, I think the notion, and let's face it, let's cut right to the chase. Why are we here to learn? We're here to learn to be better people. We're here to learn we're here to learn how to behave, how to raise our kids, how to live in the world, how to be good Jews, how to further Judaism. These are big deals, and we are looking to learn from all things that are at our disposal. That's the idea. That's the point he's trying to make. You're right that he unnecessarily focuses it very narrowly, because this is being produced to promote a book called, Conservative Judaism, Today and Tomorrow. It's not just specifically conservative Judaism, and he would be the first to acknowledge that if you spoke to him. He was a sociologist for many, many years before he became the chancellor of JTS, but right now he's really trying to get us, those of us who live and work and function within conservative institutions, to really try to look underneath the surface at what we really do, and to try to understand it better. And frankly, to be proud of what we can and should be proud of, which is often overlooked. So let's listen to the second half of this, although I don't think he really defends it, just because it's set to that, and we'll... Gotta enter my password. It doesn't remember. How do you like that? It doesn't remember. Okay. We have another minute and a half of this. Here we go. He just spoke about the word practice.
Torah is valuable for its own sake.
Yes.
But Torah is valuable because it leads to maaseh.
Leads to deeds. The question is, what do we mean by deeds?
And I think our teacher has understood that it's also true the other way around. You don't learn about friendship in the abstract. You learn about friendship out of the experience of being a friend. You don't study love by reading a treatise on love. You study treatises on love, if you do, from your experience of being someone who loved and is loved. The same thing with Judaism. Judaism binds learning to the practice that comes out of the learning and leads into the learning. The learning is, we would say in Hebrew, toch kedei. It's from the midst of Jewish life, from the midst of Jewish deeds. I'm really proud of the way conservative Jews learn. You can't learn too much because life is complicated.
Well, that's
true. Jewish wisdom runs deep. And you want to do the best job at fulfilling God's commands as you possibly can. So learning is the key for me, and I hope for you. And let's use this study as a way of reflecting on what Jewish experiences of learning have meant the most to us.
Mm-hmm.
Which ones have left us cold? Is there anything special about the way we learn Torah, whether it's the five books of Moses or Torah in the broad sense of Jewish tradition? How can we learn better? How can we make learning a more integral part of each of our lives in the coming months and years?
I actually think, I mean, he raised it up a notch toward the end. I think he's absolutely right. And this could be a nice topic for us to discuss at this time, which is basically what kind
of
learning?
I think the learning may be a distinctive aspect of conservatism.
And actually, this is funny because at least it's another time of showing the same video. Usually, when I move away from the computer, the next thing there is something I'm embarrassed to have anybody see because I don't know how this algorithm works, but somehow... It's really the other videos that come off, you know, that usually follow these videos.
That's on YouTube. And that,
yeah, this is just an intern. I see. And that's the reason that
so
it's just the same.
On YouTube, they have
oh my,
sort of related.
Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I mean, really, you could just walk away to go to the bathroom to come back, and it's like, you know, X-rated right there, which I'm sure our kids also know a lot about. So, you know, what learning has excited us? What learning has felt real and authentic and valuable? And what learning, he asked the question, and what learning has left us cold? That's a good question. That's a really good question. I'll start by just saying I think learning, you know, what occurred to me is this notion of learning by doing is that I think that the kind of learning we're talking about is not, strictly speaking, book learning. That I would agree with. It's learning from books, perhaps, but it's learning as a way of growing as a human being and as a Jew. And that's why doing Jewish, as the late Leonard Fine would say, is so valuable to this process. The idea of just embracing Jewish practices, whatever they might be, kashrut, tefillah, we'll get to tefillah in a few minutes, other things are so important because they help us grow as souls. And that's, I think, what this is really all about. But let me hear what you have to say. What learning has meant the most? What Jewish learning has meant the most? And what learning has left us cold?
Well,